On Monday, North Korea tested a nuclear bomb and followed up with a series of apparent missile tests as well. The news provoked anxious reactions in South Korea, Japan, and here in the United States, and condemnation from Russia and from North Korea's most important ally, China. The crisis tests the Obama administration's effort to engage Pyongyang and raises questions about why now, to what purpose, and how will North Korea's neighbors, the U.S. and the U.N., respond? Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. David Kong is director of the Korean Studies Institute at the University of Southern California and co-author of Nuclear North Korea, A Debate on Engagement Strategies. And he joins us today from the studios of NPR West. Nice to have you on the program today.
Nice to be here.
And Secretary of State Clinton warned today that the UN is unhappy about these tests and North Korea will face consequences. North Korea has to have seen that coming. So what kind of message are they trying to send here?
Well, I think partially they're sending a message to the outside world not to try and take advantage of the instability that's going on inside of North Korea, because it's not very clear who's going to succeed the current leader, Kim Jong-il. And so there's a lot of instability and insecurity within North Korea.
Kim Jong-il suffered a stroke, apparently, and, well, he looks terrible.
Yes, he does look terrible. He's gaunt. He used to be a sort of pudgy guy, and now he's got hollow cheeks, and he's aged about 20 years. And so while he was firmly in power, you had a sort of clear strategy, and the internal factions all basically got behind what he wanted to do. Now that it's not clear how long he's going to rule, and particularly who's going to take over, I think there's an increasing incentive inside North Korea for people to show their loyalty as they compete, as they jockey for position. And this is not the time you're going to see a sort of open North Korea.
So is this a particularly dangerous moment?
I'd say it's getting more dangerous. And in fact, the prognosis for the immediate future actually isn't that good. What we have right now is in some ways a sort of accelerating set of provocative actions by North Korea and threatening to abandon the 1953 armistice, these missile launches. And that actually, to me, indicates that they're not as focused on what's happening externally and they're more focused on internal moves because they're not spacing these things out. They don't seem to be even waiting for reaction.
Yet North Korea's neighbors, we know that they have obviously missiles, certainly capable of reaching almost every part of Japan. Now that they've detonated a second nuclear device, this one far more successfully than the first, should Japan, South Korea, Russia, China, should they assume that North Korea can now fire nuclear missiles at them?
That's a long way off. In fact, that's years off. They have a bomb. They've got a missile, but they haven't shown that they can capably put the bomb on the missile and get it to blow up. That's one reason that there's a sort of technological incentive to continue testing these things. So they don't have a demonstrated delivery capability yet, but certainly they can still do a lot of damage.
And North Korea in the past has proliferated its missile technology. It has also helped in the proliferation of nuclear technology as well. Should we assume that these weapons might be for sale?
In the longer run, there's a proliferation concern, no question about it. North Korea has been shown, as you said, to sell their missiles and their know-how to anyone who's got enough money. In the short run, North Korea isn't making any more plutonium. We know that they had enough for between, say, 8 and 12 nuclear bombs. They've detonated two, so they've only got enough for 6 or 10 left. And so it's highly unlikely that Kim is going to be selling the actual bombs until they make more. But the know-how and the technology, they certainly might sell.
And they've restarted their production plant so they can make more plutonium. And, of course, they may have highly enriched uranium, too.
Yeah, I mean, both of those are a long way off in terms of years. The Yongbyon plant, which was the main source of their plutonium, they actually dismantled that last year. There was sort of dramatic footage of them blowing up the cooling tower. And so while they can restart to build that, it's not like they can just turn a switch and start making more plutonium. The highly enriched uranium, which is the other program that they had going, was only in its initial stages. And so even that's a couple years off, which doesn't mean that the threat's not there, but it certainly isn't an imminent threat.
We're talking with David Kong, who is the director of the Korean Studies Institute at USC. If you'd like to join the conversation about North Korea, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. And Jeff is calling from Boise.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
if I remember correctly, a few years ago when North Korea did another nuclear test, China got upset and started turning off some of the power and the fuel that they were sending to North Korea. And I was wondering if that would be an option, if China would be willing to do something kind of maybe a little heavier handed this time.
Well, certainly everyone thinks that China has the most influence over North Korea. The thing we also have to remember is that still is very limited influence over North Korea. North Korea is extremely dependent on China for economic aid, for its trade. Over 50% of its trade goes to China. So, yes, if they decide to pull out a sledgehammer, they could probably cause North Korea to collapse or certainly give it extreme pain for right away. But that's a huge step to take. And China's been very cautious about ratcheting up the pressure. In a way, sort of North Korea's dependence on China is its strength, because China would have to risk actually causing the regime to collapse. And so they're very cautious about actually ratcheting up the pressure, because neither China nor South Korea really wants to deal with the consequences of a collapsed North Korean regime. Just to take a second to talk about that, not only would you have potentially hundreds of thousands of refugees going over the border, you'd have a military that may not voluntarily disarm, could start shooting at each other, and of course loose and unaccounted nukes running around the country. So too much pressure is something China is going to be very cautious about applying.
And are we going to see that at the United Nations, where they are, even as we speak, discussing a resolution in response to this missile tests and the nuclear test as well?
Yeah, I mean, China went along with the sanctions in 2006 because this is, in many ways, the first test and the second test is sort of an insult to Chinese diplomacy. I mean, China's been the country that's been trying hardest to get the U.S., North Korea, South Korea, Japan to the bargaining table. So this is, in many ways, a sort of direct slap to China. And they're quite annoyed, and there's a lot of debate within China about what to do. Ultimately, how they come out, nobody knows. My sense is that they're still going to be very cautious about applying too harsh of sanctions.
Thanks for the call, Jeff.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let me ask you also about reactions by some of the other neighbors of North Korea. We saw a quote from a former Minister of Defense in Japan saying today that given the situation in North Korea, Japan would be well advised to develop the capabilities to make a preemptive strike if that should be necessary.
Yeah, I mean, the debate in Japan over North Korea has been essentially a debate about not only a North Korean threat, but also how to deal with the 13 or 18 Japanese who were abducted by North Korea during the 1970s. This came out a couple years ago, and up until that time, into the early 2000s, Japanese policymaking in the public was basically in favor of an engagement strategy. When they actually found that North Korea had kidnapped a couple dozen of their own citizens, public opinion and particularly foreign policy opinion turned very harshly negative towards North Korea. And so Japan right now has actually fairly harsh sanctions on North Korea, and there's a lot of debate about what to do. My sense about the nuclear option is that that's more rhetorical than realistic, and that it would take a lot more threat for Japan to actually cross that barrier.
And as you look at South Korea, the present government there has been a much harder line against North Korea than the previous regime there in Seoul. And typically, in the past, the North Koreans, when the government in Seoul was hard line against them, they tried to appeal to the United States. And when the government in Seoul was in favor of engagement, they were very hard line against the United States. And now they're just seemingly provoking everybody.
Yeah, that's true. The current South Korean government under President Lee Myung-bak took power with the claim to have engagement with reciprocity, meaning that the South Korean government is happy to expand economic ties with North Korea, but they're going to make sure that North Korea gives something in return. That policy has led to a decrease in economic trade between North and South Korea, closing of some of the tourism that had been going back and forth, and a lot of rhetorical conflict on both sides. Right now, I think the Myungbak government is actually considering what they can do. But again, I think that there will be a sort of more measured and a more calm response rather than an overreaction.
Just update us, too. There were a couple of journalists, TV journalists, who work for making a film for Al Gore's TV channel, who were arrested in North Korea for filming illegally. What's their status?
Well, they're going to trial right now. They were arrested about 2 months ago. And this has actually happened to U.S. citizens before, 1989 and actually in 1994, I think it was, or 1995. Some American servicemen were on a helicopter that got lost, got shot down. The North Koreans were going to put them on trial for spying, etc. And in both previous cases, the solution was a diplomatic solution, where a high-level U.S. envoy went to Pyongyang, negotiated their release, and eventually came back with them. Right now, the U.S. is considering doing that. And probably that's the only solution to getting the two journalists back.
We're talking with David Kong, professor of international relations and business at the University of Southern California, director of the Korean Studies Institute at USC. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to Ross. Ross calling from Minneapolis.
Yes. In all the discussion about North Korea, I rarely hear the discussion about long-term plans for the West to help North Korea come out of their isolationist cocoon. How do we do this long-term?
Well, that in part was the original South Korean policy started under a president about 10 years ago, Kim Dae-jung, who called it the Sunshine Policy, based on the old, I guess, the fable about the man taking his coat off if there's enough sun, and the only way to get them to open up is by engaging. That policy led to an increase of trade between South Korea and North Korea. There are many who still think that ultimately the only way to get North Korea to change its ways is to meet them halfway and to try and get more trade and more travel into North Korea. That's on hold right now, though, partially because of a new South Korean government that thought there should be more reciprocity, and partially because I don't think any country, certainly not the United States, Japan, or South Korea, is going to move too far down that path with a nuclear-armed North Korea. The issue is always North Korea says they're willing to give up nuclear weapons for normalization and open trade relations, particularly with the United States. The U.S. says, we're also willing to do that, but you have to disarm first. And North Korea says, well, you have to normalize relations first. And so we have a stalemate. And certainly the climate right now is that the U.S. government is not going to press forward very eagerly with engagement or expansion of trade ties until there's been some progress on the nuclear front.
Ross, thank you. Let's see if we can go next to, this is Todd. Todd with us from Cincinnati.
Thanks. Thanks for taking my call. My question is pretty brief, but what is North Korea's goal? What are they trying to get out of doing this in the face of the world community?
Is it
any thoughts on that?
Is it as simple as a regime survival?
Yeah, I mean, most likely North Korean leadership is like any other dictator. They want to stay in power. The question is how best to do that. We used to think, there's a fair amount of debate about whether there was actually a chance for North Korea to negotiate away its nuclear weapons or whether they fully intended to keep them no matter what. This debate was a lot more lively 10 years ago. I think there's an increasing belief that North Korea has made a strategic decision that they need their nuclear weapons. So for regime survival. As a bargaining chip, do they really just want a relationship with the United States? It's not quite clear beyond regime survival what they're actually trying to get.
Thanks, Todd.
Thank you.
Let's go next to Chris. Chris in Minneapolis.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for the moment here. My question is simple. It's why should we as Americans care about what is going on over there? I mean, obviously there's the humanist angle. We don't want to see things like this going on. But if there's like a bully in Los Angeles, why, if I live in New York City, why should I care about a serial killer on the loose or a criminal in Los Angeles? I guess, why should we care about what's going on in North Korea?
Sure. No, that's a great question. And In some degree, we care not because North Korea can hit us with a missile, because they can't yet. They don't have the capability. The U.S. is primarily concerned with the proliferation possibility. As we mentioned a little bit earlier, North Korea has been known to sell its missiles and its weapons technology to the highest bidder. And so our concern is that North Korea will sell nuclear weapons to some terrorist group that will then turn around and use it against us.
There is also a concern. Secretary of State Clinton said today the United States is reaffirming its treaty obligations to Japan and to South Korea. And I guess the phrase nuclear umbrella has to be used there.
Well, absolutely, right? And the second major reason that we care about this is because for the U.S. to sort of idly sit by and let any country proliferate nuclear weapons is probably not good in the long run. And that's certainly a consensus in the U.S. Policymaking establishment. Finally, and just as important as any of these other reasons, is that Northeast Asia is incredibly important to the United States. Not only do we have two very long-time allies, Japan and South Korea, China is one of the biggest, most important countries in the world. And Russia, of course, shares a land border with the Korean Peninsula. And so events that happen in that region have a direct effect on the United States, economically, politically, and diplomatically. So we can't really just ignore it.
And, Chris, thanks very much for the call. We're getting another question. I'm not going to take the call, but I'll ask the question. Are there any military options?
There always are options. Are we realistically going to use them? Almost for sure not. Ever since the first nuclear crisis back in 1994, the U.S. has considered, could we do a preemptive strike? Could we do a surgical strike? What would be the possibilities of this? And that actually, ultimately, every U.S. administration, Republican or Democrat, has decided that military force is, the costs are too high. Seoul is less than 30 minutes from the border. The amount of devastation would just be unbelievable. So nobody really thinks about it.
David Kong, thank you for your time today.
My pleasure.
David Kong joined us today from the studios at NPR West. He is a professor at the University of Southern California and directs the Korean Studies Institute. Tomorrow, the next in our series, Talk of the World, would-be novelists tap out pages one text message at a time. How do people around the world use their mobile phones? Join us then. This is NPR News.